Blog Talk Radio.
Mama Africa, Mama Africa, am I coming home? Am I coming home? Hello, Mama Africa, how are you? I'm feeling fine, and I hope you're fine too. Hello, Mama Africa, how are you? I hope when you hear these words, your gray turns blue. Gray turns blue. I'm saying these words to let you know how much I care and I won't let go. Even though we're oceans away, you're
In 1950, the AIDS virus was fed to nearly 300,000 black youth in Africa in the form of an oral polio vaccine by Dr. Hilary Kaprowski, who is currently the director of viral virology at Thomas Jefferson University in Philadelphia. Today, a child dies every minute of HIV/AIDS in sub-Saharan Africa. In the U.S., African Americans represent 49% of all new AIDS cases. The globe holders, the population controllers, the AIDS makers, dark nation depopulators, the conscious trainers, American Nazi bankers, the tower bombers, right-wing Al-Qaeda sponsors, Hitler's accomplice, 9/11 mission accomplished. Free your conscience, in ghettos they kill the prophets, the juggernauts. The alphabet cops, the CIA, TFBI, the coca crops, imported to local blocks. The 5 years for the black to the month that the cracker got. A powder pot compared to a gram of rock. Got blacks at 50% of the prison pop. The whacking huts, the correction corporations, the International Planned Parenthood Federation, the forced abortion, forced sterilizations, the sons of Satan, Operation Depopulation. From 1924 to 1976, 32 states in the U.S. utilized eugenics programs to depopulate the country of so-called weak breeds who were downbreeding the American population. Some 65,000 black youth from public school districts throughout the country were given a biased IQ test. All who failed the test were sterilized against their or their parents' will. The diamond dealers, them choppers and baby killers, the oil drillers, black nation resource stealers, the truth concealers, suppression of true guerrillas, Patrice Lumumba, Nkrumah, Lauren Kabila, the people traitors, poor population enslavers, the black slash brown slash yellow baby cremators, the black slash brown slash yellow unity haters, the red slash white slash blue liberty waivers, eugenicists, world imperialists, evolutionists, black womb pollutionists, the euthanizers, third world birth sterilizers, Nazi sympathizers, finances and arms suppliers, the nuke igniters, the world health organizers, the virus writers, smallpox, Ebola slices, the throne of surface, the worst death deservers, the devil worship, more power for every murder. A 1996 expose by the San Jose Mercury News documented CIA involvement in a Nicaraguan drug ring which poured thousands of kilos of cocaine into Los Angeles African-American neighborhoods in the 1980s. Drug boss Danilo Blandon, now an informant for the DEA, acknowledged under oath the drugs for weapons deals with the CIA-sponsored Contras. The Club of Rome, World Bank, the Skull and Bones, Alhamdulillah engraved in the Pope's throne, the camouflage, the right versus left mirage, Bush and Kerry got naked to pledge in the same lodge, the Reagan years, the luminous presidents, ever since they've been facing the obelisk, the Kabbalist, Harry Potter is not a myth, this ain't on radio, but this that shit. The war on drugs has been a war on poor people, particularly poor urban African-American men and women. It's well documented that police enforcement of the new harsh drug laws have been focused on low-level dealers and communities of color. Arrests of African-Americans have been about 5 times higher than arrests of whites, although whites and African-Americans use drugs at about the same rate. African-Americans have been imprisoned in numbers even more disproportionate than their relative arrest rates. It is estimated that in 1994, on any given day, one out of every 128 U.S. adults was incarcerated, while one out of every 17 African-American adult males was incarcerated. The differential in sentencing for powder and crack cocaine is one glaring example of institutionalized racism. About 90% of crack arrests are of African-Americans, while 75% of powder cocaine arrests are of whites. Under federal law, it takes only 5 grams of crack cocaine to trigger a 5-year mandatory minimum sentence, but it takes 500 grams of powder cocaine 100 times as much to trigger the same sentence for a white boy.
Another edition of Your World News. I'm your host, Solomon, and I'm joined once again, as last week, as promised. I told you we would have Peter Fowler on much, much more, and Peter Fowler, who's joining us from sunny, well, quasi-sunny Arizona. Yeah, it's actually sunny out there, 70 degrees. He'll be playing a more integral role with Your World News with the weeks to come, and this is a place where you can consistently, regardless of what episode it is, you can consistently expect to hear a critical analysis of geopolitics, domestic issues, current events, that you will not find that same kind of critical analysis on the corporate media. Now, there are other folks out there doing unbelievable stuff, and some of those folks we're going to highlight you know, throughout the show because, you know, they've allowed us to use some of their sound bites, such as Black Agenda Report, folks like Glenn Ford and Bruce Dixon, you know. But in terms of the corporate Western media, you're not going to hear that kind of critical analysis that you'll hear on a Box Union or a Black Agenda Report or, you know, some other independent radio or online, you know, audiovisual outlets. And so, anyways, you know, once again, we are going to be breaking down some various aspects of news that have occurred within the last week and giving it the critical analysis that it deserves, that unfortunately the masses of folks out there within the stolen and artificially created borders of the United States of America won't get. But hopefully you guys that are listening, you'll pass this along to your friends, your family, and, you know, like that, the remedy, you know, that, you know, this can be the panacea to cure them of their Western corporate media slant. So, It's a blizzard out here. I'm in the belly of the beast, Washington D.C., and it is about 3 feet of snow out there, and you know, I can't think of a better way to spend my afternoon than on a snowed in day like this than to resist, to provide news and information from, you know, with a critically analytic point of view, and then also to highlight underreported, underdiscussed, under-taught aspects of Black and African history. So, anyways, without further ado, I'd like to have a co-host for the show for the next, hour and 18 minutes, Peter Fowler, if you can introduce himself, and we'll hit the ground running.
Thanks, Solomon. Always good to be with you. Again, Peter Fowler from Arizona, Glendale, Arizona, and I love the East Coast. I love the Baltimore, D.C. metroplex area, Solomon, but I can't say that I would rather be there at this point, knowing you guys are under a blizzard of snow. So I'll be glad to put my 2 cents worth in from the desert here in Phoenix, in the greater Phoenix area. Those of you that have heard me before know my position and some of my background. I do have a background in social work and ministry, various areas of corrections, and I'm currently endeavoring a new project called the Academy of Critical Thinking, which can be found at theactinc.org online. So, you know, I think it's almost symbolic, Solomon, that you're in Washington, D.C. area, and there is 3 feet of snow on the ground. I think it's symbolic of how from, you know, D.C. is really mired in a blizzard 365 days a year, whether it's snowing or not. But the climate in Washington is oppressive politically. And so it's kind of ironic that you're broadcasting today from underneath a literal blizzard of snow.
Yeah, exactly. And let's hit the ground running. There's a news bit that I want to play right now. And also, you know, excuse me for my rudeness, folks. I should have let you guys know that the call-in number is 347-945-5191. That's 347-945-5191. So at any juncture during this broadcast, if you're listening live, and as you know, this show, you know, probably almost immediately after it ends, it is archived, and so you can send the link on to all of your networks. But if you're listening live, you can call that number and join us for a dialogue. If there's something that we speak on that you want to comment on, if there's something that is going on in your community that that you want to speak on, any comments, questions, what have you, you know, please feel free to call. That number, and we'll lock you in as soon as we see you call in. But Peter and I were discussing before the broadcast of the show that you know, beyond doing the news, we wanted to focus on a different theme throughout the month and actually throughout the entire year, because Black History Month, you can't confine Black history, you know, going all the way back to antiquity Africa in just one month. I mean, you couldn't even confine Black history within the United States of America within 1 month. And so it's Black History Lifetime. And so, you know, we're going to continue to highlight folks, you know, throughout themes. And the theme of this show has to do with Black resistance and Black liberation. And, you know, we said this, it was vastly important because within mainstream institutions within America, whether it may be the corporate media or even looking at public education, you know, all the way to the tertiary level, all the way to college, you don't see Black history being taught as it should be. And there's huge, huge pockets of Black history that are left out. And so I think it's apropos for us, since we're talking about the shortcomings of public education in the United States of America, that we lead off with this news bit that has to do with none other than your President of the United States of America, his selection for Secretary of Education. That's Arne Duncan, his basketball buddy, a guy who was appointed to Secretary of Education, who has not spent a second, who had not prior to that, had not spent a second in a classroom as an educator, as a teacher, and a guy who is really in favor of the privatization of school systems. And when he was the CEO of, yes, they do call them CEOs now, you know, they used to be called superintendents, but the CEO of Chicago's public school system, he privatized many schools, but he also militarized many schools, and no coincidence that many of those schools that he militarized, that he gave authority to different branches of the U.S. military to run those schools, they were predominantly Black and brown schools. And, yes, this is Arne Duncan. And so I want to play this clip, and on the other end, I'd like Peter to lead us off to get his comments, and you know, we'll break this down and keep it moving. We're going to have sound bites from Malcolm. We're going to have sound bites from Mumia Abu-Jamal. You know, this show is going to be power-packed. So let's lead off with the scumbag Arne Duncan.
There is an old saying, a white man's heaven is a black man's hell. Arne Duncan, the U.S. Secretary of Education and President Obama's basketball buddy, is one of those white men, a disaster capitalist who sees a silver lining in the Katrina catastrophe that swept away much of Black New Orleans 4.5 years ago. Duncan's ghoulish statement that the best thing that happened to the education system in New Orleans was Hurricane Katrina is identical to the sentiments expressed by racist Louisiana whites and the Bush administration when they gushed unashamedly over the opportunities Katrina created to build a new order in the city, even as bloated black bodies still floated in the streets. Even now, as the remains of black people still ooze from shattered concrete in Port-au-Prince, Arne Duncan's disaster capitalist classmates revel in the prospect of building a new Haiti, one more orderly and advantageous to the rich. When the very existence of the poor is deemed the essence of the problem, then the ultimate logic is genocide. To the Arne Duncans of this world, there is no price too high to pay in terms of black suffering in the quest for the Obama administration's grotesque version of education reform. The destruction of a black city, the scattering of her population, these are not tragedies, certainly not crimes, but cause for celebration in the larger scheme of things, that larger scheme being the privatization and charterization of the public schools and the demise of teachers' unions. One immediate effect of Katrina was the firing of all the city's public school teachers and staff to clear the way for a hodgepodge, fractured, and highly unequal system dominated by charters and where the teachers are largely non-union, whiter, younger, with far less roots in the community. Arne Duncan attempted to achieve the same results while running the Chicago schools. For the Obama administration, New Orleans is the future, a model to be coerced into being by withholding federal funds to cities that fail to impose a parallel order of charter schools. the administration plans to step up its bullying on behalf of charter schools in its updated version of No Child Left Behind. The privatization of education that was conceived as a corporate project during the Reagan administration is now the official doctrine of the corporate wing of the Democratic Party under the first black president. One of President Obama's great allies in charterizing the public schools is Michael Bloomberg, the billionaire mayor of New York City, who's attempting to shut down 19 schools, all of them heavily black and brown, despite fierce protests from parents. The state NAACP has joined with the teachers' union in a suit to block the mass closings, warning of the establishment of a segregated, two-tier school system. Charters for the more fortunate, traditional public schools for the poor and educationally needy. To impose this two-tier system, federal policy creates deliberate crises in the traditional public schools in order to shut them down. That's disaster capitalism at work in the guise of educational reform. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford. On the web, go to www.blackagendareport.com.
And please make sure that you visit Black Agenda Report on a weekly basis if you haven't already been doing so. That's blackagendareport.com. And, Peter, I see the lights are starting to be lit by callers. But before we go to our first caller, I'd like to get your feedback on that news bit, Peter, if you will.
Yeah, that's obviously education is a concern for everybody in this country. You know, it crosses all the barriers, so it's something that we can all claim as a concern. You know, and what we're seeing from the Obama administration is the continuation of the privatization of public education that has been going on for quite some time now. And, you know, it's a significant event, you know, and the propaganda behind that, obviously, is that charter schools provide a better option for our students. You know, that is the popular propaganda that's put forth, and that when we look at that uncritically and we just digest that uncritically, it makes sense. We want the best for our students, so why not charter schools? There's a lot of reasons for why not charter schools. Just want a quick quote from Jonathan Kozol, who's been a researcher in Education America for a long time. He writes that the education industry represents the largest market opportunity since healthcare services were privatized during the 1970s. You know, so what that means is we can look at the future of education right now by looking at the healthcare industry. And, you know, that is obviously a hot topic right now with the healthcare reform in being bounced around in Washington, D.C. The state of healthcare in this country obviously is dismal. And the further privatization of public education is going to continue to drive down the level of education in this country, because what is going to be the priority in a privatized endeavor is profit, not education. Profit is going to be the bottom line in education, just like it is in healthcare. The further that the education system is privatized, the lower the level of education, and not only the level of education overall, but the level of access education. And that's an issue that is crucial, particularly as we look at healthcare, the access, who gets access and who doesn't. That's what the market does, is it creates access for some and eliminates access for others. And we're seeing that, you know, obviously post-Katrina, New Orleans was a laboratory of disaster capitalism, and we can see how access is given granted to some and denied to most of us. Another aspect to this is not only from the student's standpoint, the access to education is, I think, oftentimes a forgotten aspect of the classroom in this conversation, is the teachers and the other staff and faculty in the education system. They're also suffering, because with privatization, what privatization does is it eliminates a union strength. Oftentimes, these charter schools are anti-union, non-union. They don't allow unions to form. And as more and more teachers are joining the ranks of the charter schools, the teachers' unions and the public schools are diminished in membership and in power and in strength. And so, therefore, wages are driven down. Teachers are given greater loads in terms of more students in their classrooms, which is obviously bad on both sides of the point. So this effort to privatize public schools that we're seeing with the Obama administration, it just continuing this process, is being driven by capital, not necessarily one president or another, because it will continue under the next president, whether he or she be Democrat or Republican, whether they're one party or the other, as a candidate of capitalist parties, they will continue this drive to the bottom in public education. So it's definitely something we need to address right now before it does get any worse.
Exactly, without a doubt. And I'm glad you mentioned Jonathan Kozol. And those of you guys who are listening, that if this is nascent information and you'd like to really expand your base in terms of, you know, things that Peter touched on and referenced, you know, a great book to pick up is Jonathan Kozol, and the last name is spelled K-O-Z-O-L. And a great book is Shame of the Nation. I mean, he's written several books, but Shame of the Nation is a great book, and within that book he has a quote, and, you know, he talks about how the fact that, you know, in present times you see that school systems have become resegregated to the same levels that they were, you know, back in the 50s. And he has spent years and years and years, decades actually, documenting this information. So that and Savage Inequalities is another great book. But Jonathan Kozol, and then Peter mentioned, you know, the phrase disaster capitalism. Great book that outlines that is Naomi Klein's Shock Doctrine, and that's another book I would really implore anyone that doesn't have that to pick up those two books and really start sinking your teeth into those books, you know, for a deeper analysis, because as Peter alluded, you know, that is the push right now, you know, because charter schools are publicly funded but privately run. And so, you know, for instance, in D.C., we have public schools here that are run by private corporations based in New York City. And we have a mayor in Washington, D.C., that is very much the protege of Barack Obama. He fits the same mold that Mayor Adrian Fenty is. Man, I don't know if I have enough time to get into to the tool this guy is, but you know, we will. But anyways, we have a caller, and I want to go to line one. It seems like a caller from New York, and once again, the number is 347-945-5191. And also, the first two tracks that you heard when the show started, the first one was late great Garnett Silk, and that track is called Mama Africa. And the next song is I'm a hip hop aficionado. I love hip hop, not the corporate hip hop that these large white corporations want to put. That you know, if they were in the 30s and 20s, I mean, there would be nothing short of the minstrelly that we used to see in the 30s and 20s, and even before that.
That's
play
a good
those. Analogy. Oh yeah, they play right into all the,
yeah, exactly,
the racist stereotypes that America,
exactly,
has long cling to in terms of their depiction of Black Americans. And that, you know, that track was Wise Intelligent, and it was called Globe Holders, and Wise Intelligent, former member of Poor Righteous Teachers. But I'm going to go to the line right now. Caller, you are on the air. Hello?
Hello?
Oh, yes, you're on the air.
Oh, I'm calling from Toronto. You said New York.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. I saw the 646 area code, so I thought it was New York. Is this Brother Norman Richmond?
Yes, sir. That is.
Oh,
yeah. You're speaking to him. How are you doing?
We are honored. I am doing great. I am honored. Joined by a legend, brother.
A legend in his own mind.
And in my mind, too. In my mind, too.
Now, I wanted to talk about the fact that this is February 6th, and I don't want to disturb the flow of the show, but 50 years ago, a brother by the name of Jesse Belvin was really assassinated along with his wife in Hope, Arkansas, which is the home town of the former president of the United States, William Jefferson Clinton. And Jesse Belvin was a singer-songwriter, and many people feel he was killed. He was killed because of he was on a show with Arthur Prysock and Jackie Wilson, and they were the white audience wanted. There was supposed to be two shows, one between a one for the blacks and one for the whites, and Jackie Wilson refused to do a show for the white audience. And, you know, all hell broke loose, and apparently they cut the tires of Jesse Belvin. And Jesse and his driver were killed instantly, and his wife, Joanne, died a few, you know, days later. But, you know, I know this show is about resistance, and I should tell you what took place next was they went to New Orleans, and obviously Jesse was not on the show, but Jackie was on the show, and Jackie Wilson and a brother by the name of Larry Williams, who was from New Orleans, and they got into a little scuffle, and Jackie Wilson apparently decked a policeman and was, you know, jailed and got out of jail before, you know, they could really persecute him, and he got away. But I wanted to tell that particular story on February the 6th, and I really plan to start listening to your show every week, and I heard about you through Abiyumi Azikwe, and from what I heard so far, you got me hooked.
Thank you so much, and I've been hooked on your writings for a long time, brother. You know, for folks that don't know, this brother Norman Richmond is a tremendous historian and musicologist, and I've learned a lot about music that took place before my time, that, you know, took place when I was a child and way before that by reading different essays and articles and even hearing some interviews by brother Norman Richmond, and you know, has a wealth of knowledge that has fed into a lot of the things that I've you know, brought into, you know, various classrooms and engagements that I've been, you know, lucky to be a part of. And so it's an honor for you to say that you'll be tuning in each week, and matter of fact, you know, I would love to have you as a guest to join Peter and myself in the future.
Well, we can arrange that. I would love to do that. That would be no problem, because I'm a big aficionado of black music of all types, and I'm hooked on internet radio. It seems like this is where all of the knowledge is being passed now, because it looks like even on public radio, our microphones, as Randall Robinson would say, are getting smaller, you know, and it looks as if, you know, we're winning the battle. I guess maybe that's why our microphones are getting smaller. It looks like we are winning, but you would never know that because we can't get our message out on the radio.
Exactly. And what you brought up was with Brother Jesse Belvin, who was assassinated, that is, you know, resistance. And a lot of times people think resistance, you know, comes in a physical format, but a lot of times resistance comes by just refusing to do what, you know, the mainstream, you know, so-called power structure tries to wield, you know, upon us. So I definitely think that your comments and bringing up Jesse Belvin's was definitely apropos in terms along the lines of the theme of resistance. And I didn't know very much about that. So I thank you.
Yeah, Solomon, that's the kind of information. Thank you, Brother Richmond, for that. That's the kind of information that we do need to lift up. And those individuals and those personalities, the so-called unsung heroes of the struggle for liberation. And instead of simply lifting up February after February the same faces and the same personalities, we do need to look at the foot soldiers who did simple acts of resistance, the kinds of things that you and I can do, and anybody who's listening, the kind of things that we can all do on a day-to-day basis. You know, that's the kind of things that we need to be highlighting throughout Black History Month and throughout the course of the year when we highlight these things, whether it happened on February 6th, June 6th, December 1st, whatever, so that we don't get caught in that rut of hero worship or looking for a savior, you know, for somebody to come along to lead us out of this. I mean, look at the mess that we're in now because we thought Obama was going to come and be the next savior and lead us to the promised land. That obviously is not happening. you know. And so at some point, we've got to look to the Jesse Belvins of the world and say, you know, it's up to us, and it's up to what I can do and we can do together. So, yeah, that's crucial. That's not just, you know, a historical factoid, but that is vital information in how we go forward in the struggle.
Well, one thing you said that I really unite with is the fact that this thing is capital-driven, and it really doesn't matter who is the next president, whether they be Democrat or Republican, or whether that they be male or female, and I would like to add whether they be African origin, Asian origin, or Latino origin, you know, it's still capitalism, and it's the same old soup.
Right, definitely, without a doubt. You want to stay with us for a few minutes, Brother Richmond?
I can stay a few minutes. Yes.
Okay, I want to you know play this this next news clip and get your feedback on this since Peter and I were talking about this in terms of you know what it has to do with what's going on here in the U.S. and you know you alluded to it in terms of news that. You know, that we're winning, you know, these small, large victories, you know, in terms of getting information out there on you know, I would say non-conventional mediums, you know, outside of, you know, the mainstream print media, mainstream radio, and as well as television. And to me, you know, folks like yourself and myself and Abiyomi Ezekwe in Detroit and so many others are following the legacy of the John Russrums and Sam Cornish's, you know, from the Freedom's Journal to David Walker's Appeal and the Black Panther newspaper. So here's something that really wasn't played up too much in the mainstream media, you know, this past week. And I'm going to play the clip, and Brother Richmond, you can have the first comment on the other side.
All right.
President Obama doesn't want George Bush and his war criminals to face the bar of justice. Rather, by continuing the Bush policies of rendition, of military tribunals, of detention without trial, and all the other police state methods that have made a mockery of U.S. pretensions to decency, Obama has elevated Bush's crimes to bipartisan policy. The United States Congress doesn't want any Americans to face international justice, no matter how many crimes they commit against the planetary public. Back in 2002, just as the International Criminal Court was being formed in the Dutch city of The Hague, the U.S. Congress passed a law that would authorize Washington to send troops into Holland to free Americans who might be held for war crimes. It's been derisively dubbed the Invasion of The Hague Act, but it's no joke. The law shows how resistant U.S. politicians are to the very idea of international law, when it's applied to the United States. The U.S. refuses to sign the treaty that would bring it under the jurisdiction of the International Criminal Court, which handles war crimes, crimes against humanity, and genocide. This has created the farce in which the United States is by far the loudest voice charging other nations and individuals with high crimes against international law, but balks at leaving itself open to prosecution. From its superpower perch of impunity, the U.S. arrogantly orders the court to go after America's designated villains, all of whom have turned out to be Africans, but like a mother vulture, spreads her protective wings over the Israelis that have committed war crimes against Gaza only a year ago. One of the Davids in the struggle to make Goliath accountable to international law is Francis Boyle, professor at Illinois College of Law, who's filed a complaint with the prosecutor of the International Criminal Court to bring a select group of outlaws to justice. The rogues gallery is as follows: George Bush, Dick Cheney, Donald Rumsfeld, George Tenet, Condoleezza Rice, and Alberto Gonzalez. The Bush gang, says Professor Boyle, should answer for the crime of rendition, the kidnapping and disappearance of about 100 human beings. Boyle maintains these acts of rendition constitute crimes against humanity under the Rome Statute that created the International Criminal Court, and further, that these individuals can be prosecuted despite the fact that the United States is not a party to the Rome Statute. Professor Boyle, a recognized expert on international law, maintains that the criminal court's jurisdiction is activated when U.S. crimes are committed within the territory of other nations that have signed the statute. The U.S. has practiced renditions in a number of such countries, in Europe and elsewhere. And Boyle says if President Obama does not himself cease committing crimes begun by the Bush administration, he too could wind up under international prosecution for extraordinary rendition. And that would be extraordinary indeed. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford. On the web, go to www.blackagendareport.com.
Brother Richmond, your comments?
Well, I think following Glenn Ford is like trying to follow James Brown or Theodore Pendergrass after a concert, but I would say ditto to 99.9 of what he says. But what I think, one of the things he left out is that The Hague has gone after European leaders if they are socialists. Milosevic in Yugoslavia is an example of that. Also, there is a woman by the name of Gail Davidson, who is a lawyer here in Canada, in Vancouver, and Lawyers Against the War, and people in Toronto and in other parts of Canada have gone after Colin Powell when he came up here. They've gone after Bush. We had a demonstration against Bush when he came. And people have actually talked about making a citizen's arrest on Powell. Miss Rice was targeted in Canada, and we got Bush here in Toronto. And I think President Obama is basically following the same script and going back. President Obama, Barack Hussein Obama, is just a captain of capital, and it doesn't look like he's going to do anything different. I mean, maybe we'll be going after him in a few years for his war crimes against Afghanistan. I definitely have a problem with all of those drones, and the drone situation is something that I've always had a problem with, and I was there was a party, not a party, but when Obama was elected, the night he was elected, I was basically asked to leave the House because I really wasn't, I didn't support Mr. Obama then, and I don't support him now. And it has nothing to do with his him as an individual, because I think he's the, you know, he's intelligent and all of that, but and he was with Reverend Wright for 20 years, and I don't understand how he can be taking the positions that he takes, knowing what he knows. So that's my 3 cents.
Yeah, I totally agree. That's so interesting that you were asked to leave that party, and I haven't been at parties, but per se, but I've been around individuals who have been supremely drunk on the Obama aid. Not just before his election, but since, as you mentioned with the drones, it wasn't even 72 hours after he took the oath of office that he started to order those drones. And, now we know that those drones are have taken out wedding parties, have taken out funerals, have killed scores of non-combatant innocent civilians. And this guy, is hailed around the world as some kind of man of peace, receiving that very dubious award, the Nobel Peace Prize. It's just amazing. And he has audacity to get on, and when he accepts the award, to say that he's been influenced, by Dr. King, knowing that it was Dr. King that, April 4th, 1967, said that, the United States is one of the greatest purveyors of violence and terrorism in the world, and the three ills, racism, excessive materialism, the excessive military. I mean, it's just kind of sickening that
and for him to be talking about. I'm sorry for cutting you, but
no.
Talking for him to be talking about a just war and an unjust war. And there are just wars and unjust wars, but the war that America is waging in Afghanistan is not a just war. Maybe if I was in Afghanistan, maybe to drive the U.S. out, it would be a just war. But definitely the U.S. and Canada is in there as well. It's not, you know, I should talk a little bit about Stephen Harper, the
right wing.
You know, the right wing. He's a no piano playing, no singing. At one point he was to the right of Bush, and on the question of Israel, he's definitely, he's the most right wing, I guess, head of state in the world outside of Israel.
Yeah, I would echo that. You guys in Canada have your own version of Condoleezza Rice up there too within his administration, I believe. I can't remember the sister's name.
You're talking about Mikhail Jean?
Yes, that's the name. Yes. So, yeah, I don't know. Peter, do you have any comments?
Oh, yeah, of course. And it's interesting that we just got done talking about a foot soldier, a lesser-known foot soldier by the name of Jesse Belvin, and then we moved to a story in which, you know, Condoleezza Rice is being implicated as part of the Bush administration for crimes against humanity and so forth. All right, what's the connection there? Well, this is Black History Month. And so I think it raises the question as to what persons and stories do we tell and highlight during Black History Month. And, you know, Condoleezza Rice, obviously, yes, a historic and monumental appointment for not just a Black American, but a Black female to be appointed to a position that high in the federal government. You know, it's certainly a worthy achievement. But you look at what she did with that position, and she certainly didn't do anything to forward the agenda of Black Americans, much less most Americans in general. And at the same time, we had just looked at very briefly Jesse Belvin, you know, somebody that most people don't know about, but who took a stand for the right thing, and who took a stand in defiance of the power structure and against oppression and against racism, you know, and paid the ultimate price for it. You know, so let's compare those two, and who do we want to highlight? And, of course, we know who the corporate media is highlighting. You know, they're going to highlight the Condoleezza Rices and the Clarence Thomases and the Susan Rices of the world. So, you know, we need to be mindful of how that's played out. You spoke just a minute ago about the minstrel shows, 50 years ago, 80 years ago, 100 years ago, and how we can parallel that to the way corporate media is expressing, you know, the hip-hop music. Well, it's the same thing they're doing with in other areas, you know. So that's something that jumped out at me. In terms of, you know, Condoleezza Rice's role in that. It's Black History Month. You know, what do we do with a Condoleezza Rice, you know, as a person, as a Black American? How do we look at her, you know, and how do we tell her story, and in what context? You know, do we want to tell our little girls to grow up to be Condoleezza Rice's? I don't know.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. And Norm, you were kind of alluding to this when you said that, you know, how does someone be a part of Reverend Wright's congregation, be a part of, you know, Trinity Church in Chicago for 20 years.
For 20 years, right.
For 20 years and emerge. And you know, Obama's nothing short of, a sellout. The more involved he's become in mainstream politics, the more right he's gone. And it's really, I despise the guy. I mean, I didn't vote for him. I voted for Cynthia McKinney. Just based on how he was voting as a U.S. senator, how he supported FISA, when he distanced himself from Reverend Wright, when he, you know, he feels the need to go into, you know, Black churches, knowing that the cameras are on, and have the audacity to sit there in front of millions upon millions of white Americans who no doubt have, you know, at the very least, latent racist, you know, stereotypical ideals or ideas of Black Americans, and sit there and have the audacity to lecture them on fatherhood. Now, it's one thing to hold these meetings, you know, within a closed door, but knowing that and to sit there and lecture, I mean, because this Negro knows that he would never, never white folks would never allow him to go into Cornerstone, you know, church in, John Hagee's Cornerstone Church in Texas, or even that fool that he had, you know, during his inauguration, the guy that wrote the Rick Warren. You know, he knows he would never go into a predominantly white church and sit there and lecture, you know, a bunch of white men on fatherhood. No way. You know, and way too many of us have drank this Kool-Aid to allow this Negro to come in and do this stuff. I mean, he did it, you know, at the 100th anniversary of the NAACP, going there and said during that speech, saying that, yes, you know, your kids have to work, you know, 2 and 3 times harder sometimes, but it makes them stronger. Who, you know what I'm saying? What? I mean, and that's basically saying accept it. Accept the fact that, yes, you know, your kids are going to fall prey to the wrath of institutional racism and white supremacy in this country, but just accept it. Take it. Accept it. And look at me. The more I distance myself from black issues, from African issues, the more the white man, Massa, has pushed me up and pushed me up. And if you do that, I mean, you can get to the top of whatever corporate ladder or career that you want. Look, I made it to the top of, you know, President of the United States of America, and damn well know that if I was addressing any black issues, I wouldn't have been elected. And that speaks volumes. That speaks volumes to his character and how this guy has been packaged to so many millions and millions of black Americans. I mean, black folks worldwide, but specifically looking within the borders of the United States of America, it sets a very, very dangerous precedent. Very, very dangerous precedent.
You know, another thing that BHO did, which I really despise, is that he liquidated Black Music Month, and he's made it African American Appreciation Month. And I know when the Black Music Association, which I was a part of, came into existence, one of the things that they did was to put Bob Marley and the Wailers and Stevie Wonder together, and trying to bring together, you know, one of the criticisms of Black Music Month came from a lot of the jazz musicians because they felt that they were neglected. But I know that they were trying to bring together black music as black music, be it from blues to reggae to calypso to African music. That was one of their themes. And I know that was one of their themes because there was talk about having a convention in Nigeria at that particular time. But what the great Barack Hussein Obama has done, as he's made it African-American Appreciation Month, and I don't know what that means in terms of, and I know he's not using the term African-American like Carlos Cooks used it to mean black, you know, African people in the Western Hemisphere. When Obama's using African-American, I'm certain that he's talking about those people between, you know, in the United States, not even Canada.
Right. Brother Richmond, you mentioned Bob Marley. And in the context of everything we're talking about, as when you mentioned him, one of my favorite Bob Marley tunes came to mind. And that's the tune I'm sure you're familiar with, 400 Years. And in that tune, Bob Marley says, 400 years of the same philosophy, and my people still don't see. You know, and those words still ring true.
I think that's Peter.
Yes.
That was Peter. That wasn't Bob. That was Peter Tosh singing, yeah. And Peter doesn't get any credit, but yeah, that's the Wailers, right? So the same group, but that was Peter Tosh did 400 years.
Well, Marley also performed that. Whether or not the authorship,
okay, yeah.
I'll defer to you on that. But I'm familiar with Bob Marley's version of it. In addition to Peter Tosh, is correct, right? But that speaks volumes, you know, and it's so true, you know, 400 years, the same philosophy, and we're still struggling against that, and we're seeing the crime that Obama is, as an African-American, in a position that he's in, and he continues to, I'll use your word, to liquidate not just the language for that particular observation, but for so many other critical things.
Maybe we should change his name to the Liquidator.
I think that would be appropriate. That would be appropriate.
And brothers, I want to, and someone who I know, saw directly, you know, growing up, Brother Richmond. I want to actually compare and contrast. I want to get your feedback on this clip I'm about to play, Brother Richmond, because I know that this was someone that you have a lot of deference for. And, you know, what I found despicable, the same way that we see the repackaging of Dr. King every year, you know, repackaged, you know, in this cute little fuzzy Mogwai. And for that's a little old Gremlins the movie reference. That Mogwai is a little cute little fuzzy creatures before they turned into gremlins. And every year the brother is repackaged each and every year. And so we saw, like, during this Obama's campaign, we saw, you know, these T-shirts that had Obama juxtaposed next to Dr. King. And at the bottom is saying that the dream, you know, the dream has been achieved, you know. And I don't believe Dr. King ever said that his dream was to see black men in the office of president. He made one reference one time that he believed that there would be a black person elected, you know, to the president of the United States of America sometime in the future. He said he probably wouldn't see it, but that wasn't any dream of his. But here's an individual that also has been, you know, just kind of, you know, image-wise compared to Obama. And I think it's just absolutely disgusting. So I'm going to play this clip. It's very, very short. And get your feedback, you guys' feedback after this.
We are Africans, and we happen to be in America. We're not Americans. We are people who formerly were Africans who were kidnapped and brought to America. Our forefathers weren't the pilgrims. We didn't land on Plymouth Rock. The rock was landed on us. We were brought here against our will. We were not brought here to be made citizens. We were not brought here to enjoy the constitutional gifts that they speak so beautifully about today. Because we weren't brought here to be made citizens today, now that we've become awakened to some degree and we begin to ask for those things which they say are supposedly for Americans, they look upon us with hostility and unfriendliness. If you're interested in freedom, you need some judo, you need some karate, you need all the things that will help you fight for freedom. Nationalism is the wave of the present and the future. It is nationalism that's bringing freedom to oppressed people all over the world. It was nationalism that brought freedom to the Algerians. It was nationalism that brought freedom to the Nigerians and to the Ghanaians. It was nationalism that brought freedom to the people of Uganda and Tanganyika and Sudan and Somaliland. The Africans didn't get it by sitting in. They didn't get it by waiting in. They didn't get it by singing, "We Shall Overcome." They got it through nationalism. And you and I will get it through nationalism. What is it? What is it that makes it difficult for the philosophy of nationalism to spread among the so-called Negroes? Number one, they think they have a stake in America. They think they have an investment in this country, which we do. We invested 310 years of slave labor, 310 years, every day of which your and my mother and father worked for nothing, not 8 hours a day. There was no union in that day. They worked from sun up until sundown, from can't see in the morning until can't see at night. They never had a day off. And on Sunday, they were allowed to sit down and sing about when they died, they wouldn't be slaves no more. When they died, they wouldn't be slaves no more. They'd go up in the sky, and every day would be Sunday. That's a shame. And it is that 310 years of slave labor that went in, that was my and your contribution into this particular economy and political system. They can give us the back pay. Let's join in. If this is what the Negro wants, let's join him. Let's show him how to struggle. Let's show him how to fight. Let's show him how to bring about a real revolution. Let's make him stop jiving. You don't need a debate. You don't need a filibuster. You need some action.
Brother Richmond?
Oh, that was, what's that, Omar Wali, El Hajj, Malik El Shabazz, Malcolm X, Malcolm Little, or whatever you want to call him.
Yes, it was.
But I think it's kind of sad when you consider the fact that Barack Hussein Obama spent 20 years in Chicago, and which is the same place that Fred Hampton came from.
Yes.
And Fred Hampton and Barack Obama studied the same two speakers. That was Malcolm X and Dr. King.
Uh-huh.
And you can hear. What is that? The congressman or the senator that called Obama out? Was it Harry Reid or what's his name?
When he was giving his speech on the floor.
No. The guy who said that Obama speaks black when he.
Oh yeah, that was Harry. Yeah, Harry Reid from Nevada. Yeah.
But he was right.
Senator Harry.
He's right, because Obama can sound like Malcolm X if he wants to, because he knows all of that stuff.
Yeah.
I remember we used to have these debates when we were coming up about who was the best speaker, Malcolm or Martin, and most people supported Malcolm, you know, his position, but you know they would say in terms of when it comes to speaking, King was a better speaker, you know, because I guess at that time a lot of us were impressed by the prodigious hilltops, you know, the bombastic sesquipedalian etymology of Dr. King, you know,
right?
Where Malcolm spoke, you know, directly. We supported Malcolm, but we would say that, you know, King. Some of us said that King was a better speaker because he had a more flowery vocabulary. But and I think Obama is the which is another reason why when you refer to him as a Negro, I can understand it, because he is he's coming across as a con man, because
exactly.
he knows so much more. Like when he went, you know, like everybody was shocked when he said Assalamu Alaikum when he spoke in Cairo. He lived in Chicago for 20 years. He heard Assalamu Alaikum maybe 50 times a day.
Yeah, right, exactly.
That's the Nation of Islam's headquarter, you know. So I mean, I grew up in the States, and I mean, I knew about Assalamu Alaikum. I mean, just like when he did the thing with Hanukkah. I mean, he did a Hanukkah thing, but no Kwanzaa. Although I'm not a Kwanzaa person, if you're gonna have Hanukkah, why couldn't you have Hanukkah? Why can't you have Kwanzaa?
Right.
But Obama doesn't want, like, I agree with you. He doesn't want to have anything Afrocentric on his plate.
Exactly. Yeah. It's really, man, it's a sad thing here in the States, man, because it's the task is to really try to get to folks, you know, that are still in this trance, that still think that you know, stuff has improved markedly, you know, for black folks because of his existence within the White House, as if he was this, you know, panacea over all the social issues that have wreaked havoc upon the black community from coast to coast. And, you know, we have, presently in 2010, the average black person gets paid 62 cents to the dollar of the average, you know, white person, you know, and that, you know, that's a little more than a nickel improvement over the last 40 some odd years. And at this pace, it will take, you know, well into 600 years if there's no kind of progressive intervention for black folks to reach, you know, economic parity. And it's, you know, it's really disgusting, man, that it, you know, to really see how just his presence in the White House has really taken hold of the consciousness of so many African Americans. And I'm just trying to figure out, you know, when and how they can be woken up to the reality that he's not the answer to your issues. Matter of fact, he's run from your issues. He's made it quite clear that, you know, that he doesn't even find the fact that African Americans have the highest unemployment rate in the country, doesn't find it to be anything that would warrant a target economic plan. But when he was asked about Latinos 15% unemployment, he said that's a national crisis. But then when April Ryan, you know, the White House correspondent, mentioned that African Americans were approaching, you know, 19%, and if we know that the Bureau of Labor and Statistics say 19%, that it's, you know, it's probably about 10 percentage points higher than that. And he said, oh, you know, I don't see any need for a target. I believe that he used the quote from Ronald Reagan, the evil devil Ronald Reagan, that said that, you know, if I raise the water, the tide, then all the boats will rise, you know. But he wouldn't, Norman and Peter, he wouldn't even mention any kind of issue related to that. But just a few minutes earlier, he had said that the Latino unemployment rate was a national crisis. So,
well, you know, I lived in the same neighborhood. When I lived in Chicago, I lived in the neighborhood that Obama lived in on the south side of Chicago. And I attended frequently attended Trinity UCC. Jeremiah Wright was the pastor at the time. And the Nation of Islam presence is ubiquitous in the south side of Chicago. So, yeah, Obama came out of that kind of a context on the south side of Chicago, but he obviously has repudiated that, whether maybe not in words, but certainly in deeds. He's obviously not speaking like the south side of Chicago. He's not speaking for or on behalf of the south side of Chicago, and we could see that. And, you know, one of the things we can argue about Malcolm X and Martin Luther King in terms of their abilities as orators. And obviously they were both gifted and powerful, not just orators, but leaders. And what troubles me is when I hear folks say that they equate Obama's orations and some of his speeches with Martin Luther King's, particularly the so-called speech on race that Obama delivered in, I believe it was in Philadelphia in 2007 when he was on the campaign trail. And, you know, so many folks were comparing that to the oratory of Martin Luther King and how he was lifting these great ideals. And you know what? That's just not true. You know, he's certainly a good speaker. There's no question. He's a polished speaker. He, in terms of the substance of his orations, he doesn't anywhere near approach Martin Luther King or Malcolm X. So, you know, that's something that we need to challenge whenever that is mentioned. And when folks start talking about Barack Obama as an orator, you know, he's a speech giver, just like Ronald Reagan was. You know, and he has his talking points, and he stresses his conservative ideology. And he might try to assuage Black America or Democratic or Left America. He might try to do that with some of his oratorical flourishes, but he is nowhere. He's not even in the same classroom as Martin Luther King or Malcolm X when it comes to the substance of his speeches. And, you know, going back to the question of nationalism, which Malcolm was talking about in that excerpt, you know, nationalism is a crucial issue. You know, we can see that as a thread throughout some of these news clips that we've looked at in terms of the United States basically of thumbing its nose at international law, because it's, you know, that's a continuation of the centuries-old ideology of American exceptionalism. You know, it's nationalism gone wild. It's nationalism on Uber steroids. And, you know, the sin of Jeremiah Wright and what he has been flogged for publicly was his refusal to kowtow to the rampant nationalism, this obscene patriotism, when, you know, that excerpt from one of his sermons a few years ago, because he refused to bow to the god of nationalism. And so we see some of these guys, Barack Obama and the other brother that Nolan mentioned a few minutes ago, that have come out of Reverend Wright's church and coming out of that context, and yet and still we see their policies and their politics today it's just a triumph of that nationalism and the poison of that U.S. exceptionalism.
Right, right.
I agree.
And Brother Richmond, I was going to ask you if you had any comments, because you mentioned that this meeting that you know folks are starting to use now to really resist and get the word out in terms of information that is not, you know, commonly put out there, and get that critical analysis and you know, really embodies everything about community radio, but using it over the web, you know, it's been, you know, in some ways not an exact leveling of the playing field, but it's a medium that I enjoy using. It's a way for me to get information out there, but it's been under attack recently, and there's the whole debate that's going on, you know, around net neutrality, you know, and I wanted to play this clip because I don't think a lot of folks know about net neutrality and the debate that's going on in Congress and both sides of the House, and how now, you know, the NAACP, which you know has these strong like corporate ties with folks like Comcast and AT&T, how they are starting to influence the NAACP, which should be battling on behalf of people of color throughout the U.S. They're battling on behalf of the large corporations, so that they, you know, and I'll play this clip really quickly. And I'd really like to get your feedback, Brother Richmond, as well as Peter, because I think this has a lot to do with just the fact that we're on air right now on the web.
The battle for democracy in the 21st century is increasingly being waged on the Internet to such a degree that a movement for people's power in the United States seems inconceivable without free and unfettered access to the Internet. Yet, established civil rights organizations, whose relevance has long been under question, have sold out the people's Internet rights in a bargain with the giant telecommunications corporations. As the Federal Communications Commission prepares to rule on fundamental issues of Internet neutrality, the NAACP and the League of United Latin American Citizens, LULAC, have aligned themselves with the likes of Verizon, AT&T, and Comcast. The Urban League and the National Council of La Raza are claiming to have open minds, but look ready to go where the money is. The FCC's net neutrality ruling will decide whether the telecom corporations will be allowed to monopolize the Internet for their own profit, whether all ideas and enterprises will have equal rights to travel on the Internet, or it becomes a toll road for the billionaires. As a letter to the FCC, signed by 20 organizations, puts it, the principle of Internet neutrality allows all Americans to speak for themselves without having to convince large media companies that their voices are worthy of being heard. When corporations rule, only money has free speech rights. That's the kind of Internet environment that Verizon, AT&T, and Comcast want to establish, and they're willing to spread millions of dollars around to buy black and brown people's support. White Internet activists have shied away from calling the deal cut between the telecom companies and the NAACP, LULAC, and others by its name, but we won't. It's bribery, theft of the people's trust, a depraved sellout on a massive scale. Sadly, it's a path of betrayal already taken by most of the Congressional Black Caucus 3.5 years ago. Back then, the same cable and phone companies were trying to undo regulations that forced them to serve the poor as well as the rich. The telecoms pulled out all the stops. In addition to contributing heavily to caucus members' campaigns and offering blandishments to influential black community groups, the phone companies coerced thousands of their employees in districts around the country to call their congresspersons and push the company line. Progressive black caucus members told us that the pressure was nearly unbearable. In the end, 2/3 of the black caucus caved in to the corporations. only 13 members held out for the people's interests, while 27 bowed down to the power of money. Now it's the NAACP's and the Urban League's turn to show if they still deserve to call themselves civil rights organizations. Make no mistake about it, no civil right will be safe or even defensible if corporate America is allowed to decide who travels the information highway and who does not. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford. On the web, go to www.blackagendareport.com.
And brothers, I'd love to get your take on that because, you know, since 1996, the Telecom Act of 1996 in the U.S., which was rubber stamped by Bill Clinton and was pushed by the Republican-led Congress, really set the tone, for large corporations to really take over. Before 1996, if you were a corporation, you could only own 40 radio stations, AM and FM, and after that, you have like the likes of Clear Channel now, owning more than 1,200 radio stations across the country. And within 3 years of that act, the black ownership of radio decreased 70%. And so now, you see the attack on the internet, where if net neutrality is not upheld, folks trying to tune into my radio show or other radio shows, or even going to Black Agenda Report or Alternet or Counterpunch or sites like that, it could literally take them, 45 minutes, a half hour to just download simple pages, because there would be two internet highways, one for folks that have the money to pay, and then one for those that don't have the money to pay. And those that don't have the money to pay, it's going to be a very slow, bottlenecked highway. And, that's really, it would be a huge retardation on folks' access to information. Any comments or thoughts on that?
I think Peter should speak first since I've been running my mouth so much.
Thank you, Brother Nolan. This is connected to the item we talked on earlier about education. The corporate supremacy in various aspects of our life in America. We talked about public education at the outset. And now we're talking about communications, particularly with the internet, and it is another example, another crucial example of the ideology of corporate supremacy in this country, and as well as what kind of fuels that corporate supremacy. Obviously, is ownership, private ownership, and in order to generate profit, and so. That's the take I take on the internet issue, is another power grab by corporate interests to gain control of the internet, obviously for the sake of profit on their behalf, as well as a way to marginalize, minimize, if not completely ostracize, voices of dissent. Like this radio show, Solomon, there is a distinct possibility, as you mentioned, that corporate control of the internet could further minimize people's access to shows like this and to Black Agenda Report and the news that that people like yourself and Glenn Ford and others are trying to bring out. I mean, it's hard enough for us with limited resources compared to corporations to try to reach people with information when we're battling against, the corporation and their propaganda machine. So, it's important that we understand what's going on and really not allow the corporations to run over the right for folks to access information without having to deal with ownership issues, and it almost seems ridiculous when you really think about it. Outside of, an American capitalist construct, that how could anybody, own, the airwaves? But if you look at what's going on around the world, corporations are claiming ownership of oil, obviously that's been going on for years. Now water, you know, corporations are claiming ownership of water out here in the American Southwest. That's becoming an issue, you know, in terms of access to fresh water. You know, so this is another tentacle of this beast of global capitalism in its attempts to basically own everything and decide and control who gets what. And obviously, the folks who have the least are going to have the least amount of access and the least amount of ability to access information as well as other services on the internet and other medium. And it's doubly troubling to see organizations, historically civil rights organizations, to be on the side of the corporations, you know, that the NAACP would actually line up behind corporations in virtually any sphere, but particularly behind this. When we've known, one of the catchphrases or buzzwords for the last several years is what, the digital divide. When we look at minority communities and people of color having less access to the internet, and so that makes it even more troubling that if, you know, there's a greater corporate stranglehold on access to the internet and other now free, relatively free media, that people of color, low-income people, minority communities will have even less access to it. And obviously, that's troubling for a lot of reasons.
Thank you. Good, very good insight. Brother Richmond, I'll let you have the last word of on this issue and the show. And before we go off the air, I have a special treat, you know, wrapped in a pretty bow for you. The last song that I'm going to play is in deference and honor to folks like Brother Norman Richmond who continue to tell the stories about you know, black music, you know, from the jazz from the 1960s jazz revolution to the resistance that was throughout the words of folks like Bessie Smith and Ma Rainey and the blues era. So I'll let you have the last word, Brother Richmond.
Well, I wanted to say that I was on a radio station in Toronto called CKLN, which was a campus community station, and I was forced off in December of 2008, and I was forced off because there was a right-wing takeover of the station, and they were coming after people like me, and I think they targeted me as being the ringleader.
Mm.
And since the station has gone back up, and I'm still not on because of some union issues, but what I did when I first was relieved of my duties, I still do interview Gerald Horn quite a bit, and I put up what I call the Horn Report by Gerald Horn. And Gerald Horn has a new book out called Mau Mau in Harlem, you know, which is dealing with the whole liberation of Kenya and how the Africans in America responded to that. And recently I have been started doing a show on Uhuru Radio. I took my music show on Uhuru Radio, and I listen to Black Agenda. You know, it comes out every Wednesday or Thursday. I listen to that religiously. And also, there is a station out of San Francisco called KPOO. And I listen to that. They have everything on there from reggae to even Irish shows, and you might be listening to a Palestinian show, and they would have a commentary on Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Wow.
But also there is a Amy Goodman. I think she does some good work. I think she could have some more people from the Black radical tradition on her show. But aside from that, I like to encourage people to listen to her. She's on the use of the internet as well as, I guess, regular radio. And also there's an internet situation called The Real News. That's done by a Euro-Canadian by the name of Paul Jay. He's on every day with The Real News, and he's interviewed people like Glenn Ford and Bill Fletcher and and he has an excellent documentary on Haiti. and he does a lot of stuff around labor, and he's semi-critical of Mr. President Obama. So I think people would I would encourage people to like give him a look, because I agree with Chairman Mao Zedong: no investigation, no right to speak.
Yeah. Oh man. Yeah. Those are great suggestions you gave. Yeah. Democracy Now. You know, with Amy Goodman, and yeah, it's a good show that, you know, if you're looking for information and some critical analysis on a lot of global issues. And yeah, I totally agree with you. I've, you know, long said that, yeah, she could definitely use a lot more folks from the Black community that have radical voices on her show. But it's a good, you know, it's good for what it is. And, you know, you're going to get a lot more critical analysis and news that you just won't find on the likes of MSNBC, the white supremacist Fox News, and CNN and so forth. So I definitely concur with everything you said. And go on. Yeah,
I've been listening to a woman by the name of Margaret Prescott. I think she's on KPFK, and she has Gerald Horn. She has a roundtable, I think, Tom Hayden and Gerald Horn every Friday. You know, I listen to her, and you know, a lot of time. Women have been marginalized in the media as well. So, you know, it's not just us men folks that have anything to say. Sometimes a lot of us men don't have anything to say, really.
Exactly. We very, very much so. And oftentimes we need to take our marching orders from women. I mean, you know, like I said, I voted for Senator McKinney. And
so did I.
She was... you know,
that makes three of us.
Yeah, and continues to be a strong dissenting voice, you know, against injustice, not just within the United States, but throughout the world. And there are a lot of, you know, cowardly chicken shit, you know, men, you know, that are within the CBC that don't have half of the moxie that Senator McKinney has now, or even when she spent 12 years, you know, of her life in Congress, you know, representing a district in Atlanta, Georgia. With that being said, I want to say that the door is always open to you, Brother Richmond, and I look forward to having a show with you where we can break down music, and Peter will be joining me. And, you know, I know Peter's email, if anyone has been listening, they want to contact Peter, his email is peter.fowler, F-O-W-L-E-R, @yahoo.com. And Brother Richmond, do you have
email?
Any contact information? Yeah, that you'd like to give out?
You can email me at norman.o.richmond@gmail.com.
That's norman.o.
Richmond. @gmail.com, Richmond, R-I-C-H-M-O-N-D, just like Richmond, Virginia, or Richmond, California.
Okay, and please, if you want, this brother is one of the foremost historians when it comes to the history of Black music in the world. So if you want to get some more information, I implore you guys to email him. I emailed him, you know, a couple of weeks ago, and I immediately got a response back. And that's when you know that someone's for real. Because a lot of folks, you know, if they don't know you, and they're, you know, of the stature of a Brother Richmond, that, you know, they, you know, you can tell whether they're real or not, because they may just ignore that email. And he got back to me, and we've been exchanging emails since. And I'm so glad that he tuned in. That's why.
Yeah, it was a pleasure having you with us, Brother Richmond.
And it's nice talking to both of you, and, you're out in exactly where are you?
I'm in Glendale, Arizona.
Oh, Glendale, Arizona. All right. So you don't have asthma, do you?
No, sir, I don't.
No, I'm just Arizona is a place where people go for that's sort of a bad joke, I should say.
This weather cures a lot of ailments. And I've just relocated out here. I just moved.
I wish I was there with you.
I tell you what, this I don't miss the weather back east right now. So as much as I love that part of the country, I'm kind of glad I'm right here right now.
I think I'd rather be in Toronto right now than be in D.C. for what the brother's
doing. I'd rather be in Toronto with you as well. So this is for you. The last track we're going to play, and we'll see you next week on Your World News. Thank you for tuning in. Please pass this link along to all of your networks. And this tune is specifically from myself and from Peter to Brother Richmond. And this is the hip-hop community showing deference to 1960s jazz revolution.
The social systems influence the wisdom, hit 'em. The nation's politics inspired the apocalypse. Inner city living, synonymous to third world. This era predates Marvin, what's going on. Holiday songs, Lee Morgan on horns. The breakdown of the family structure, gotta be strong. Keep moving on, change is constant. Langston to painted pictures of the way the Renaissance went with words. He shared stories with such eloquence. Said it was a contradiction to be black and American. Phenomenal insight was shared during depression by intelligent scientists who walked the urban sections of this wilderness. Spilling us from then to now, looking back to move forward. From then to now, had the Panthers in the West, the nations on the East Coast. Malcolm and Martin both were sent back by the toast. Uprise, blaze the fires, the ghetto U.S. Only to destroy the economies of you and us. Wicked systems we trust for too long now. History repeats itself. See, we know more now. How to break the chain, how to change the game, how to heal your soul and ease the pain. I write expressions representing the extensions of a man. We're here to answer your questions and lend a helping hand. So lend your ear, cause we're here, my friends. The 1960s jazz revolution, again. Lend us the ear, cause we're here, my friends. The 1960s jazz revolution, again. Please lend the air, here my friend, the 1960s jazz revolution, again.